The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but there are so many different religions in the world, sometimes it's hard to keep up with what everybody believes. Well, that's true, my friend. That's very true. And this was the subject of an interesting question from one of our regular listeners. Brian listens to us all the way from Texas, thanks to the live stream we have on the computer. And here's what he says. He says, on the way home from work Saturday morning, getting on the bus, I decided to say a quick hello to people I see every weekend and see what they are up to. Based on their interactions, I think they're brother and sister. They always get off where I get off at my apartment, but walk the other way. Guy said they go to church. He said they were Buddhists. Didn't even know there was a Buddhist church close by. But what are they? What do they believe, and why do these believers go to a church? I could do a wiki search, but not sure I'd get what I'm looking for. When you have a minute, can you throw me a quick rundown? Well, Brian, thank you. And you'll always get more here than a wiki search, I should say. Very unreliable information at times. And Brian, did you ever ask a timely question? Even before getting your email, we, about a month ago, had a Buddhist scheduled as a guest. And here to introduce her is co-host Kevin Conover. Kevin, welcome back to our program.
Thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate it. And had a great show last week. And I'm really looking forward to having a good discussion with our guest today. This is Kelsang Chokyi, and she is of the new Kadampa tradition of Buddhism. She's a resident teacher at the Kadampa Meditation Center in Point Loma. And so, Kelsang, thank you, Chokyi. Thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Well, I wanted to start off the show by just getting a little bit of background from you about why you decided to become a Buddhist nun, and you have been for some time now. And when we were talking earlier, you had told me that you grew up in a Catholic family and then you had eventually decided to become a Buddhist. And just wanted to hear why you decided to do that.
Yes, it was a good question. I mean, I always tell people I didn't birth becoming a nun. You know, my mom didn't birth a nun.
Sure, yeah.
And I actually grew up going to Catholic schools and actually went through 2 years of a Catholic college before transitioning over to University of Southern California, where I finished my studies. But it's interesting because what I noticed when I was growing up is I heard a lot in the church, but when I go to the parking lot, people weren't always acting out the teachings or what the minister was trying to have us understand. And one of the things I noticed with myself was I was the same. Like, I could easily get angry, or I didn't hold a lot of compassion. And I didn't want that. I wanted actually to be able to control my mind. And I just didn't find the answers I was looking for in Catholicism. I had a lot of questions that weren't answered.
So you like the nun part of Catholicism, but not the rest of it.
Exactly. Okay. Actually, I'm a third generation nun in my family. The first Buddhist,
wow,
though.
Wow.
We'll have to do the Sound of Music, the Buddhist edition here.
Well, that's very interesting. And then, can you explain for our guests? A lot of our guests don't have a clear understanding of Buddhism. People, you know, see people in robes and everything, but they don't really know kind of what is the driving goal of Buddhism. And I, teaching on this subject, I know a little bit. I'm sure you know more than I do. But the Four Noble Truths, is that kind of the foundation of Buddhism there?
Yeah, the Four Noble Truths are definitely the foundation of Buddhism. And there's different sects of Buddhism, like as we were saying earlier. But Buddha Shakyamuni was the first to actually through meditation, realize his mind directly, meaning he understood how things really are rather than how they appear. He trained his mind to abandon those things that were negative and to cultivate those virtuous states of mind like patience, compassion, and in particular, wisdom. He was able to have a direct realization of emptiness.
Could you also tell us a little bit about Buddha himself? Because one of the confusions is I know some people think that Buddha is actually worshipped, and he himself never aspired to be venerated like that. So a little bit about him and then the difference between his original teachings, and then you said that you're following a modern kind of Buddhism with the follower or with the person that you just mentioned, that brand of it. So this, our audience can get the distinction here.
Sure. I just want to quickly just conclude, though, with Kevin's question in that Four Noble Truths is the basis. So when Buddha Shakyamuni arose from meditation, he gave these teachings on the Four Noble Truths, which are understanding the true sufferings, true origins, true cessation, true paths, and true cessations. So what we understand is life is suffering. Everyone has to be born, grow old, get sick, and die. And everyone has to encounter things they don't like, be separated from loved ones, right? And have their wishes go unfulfilled. These are types of suffering that every living being has to experience.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting here is that there is a similarity here in Buddhism and Christianity in that Christ said, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. So to a certain degree, there is a, we can look at the things that are similar in Christianity and Buddhism and then look at the things that are different and how we approach those issues. But so number one would be life is suffering.
Right.
And then what was number two?
The origins. Where is the suffering coming from? So from Buddhist perspective, it's coming from our self-cherishing, what we call self-cherishing or self-grasping. So self-cherishing is when I'm thinking I'm more important than you and neglecting your happiness and freedom. And self-grasping is thinking you're independent, separate from me. So from a Buddhist perspective, we understand that everything's a dependent arising. My mind actually is not independent from you. Okay, you're arising like last night's dream from my mind. So Buddha said everything, all phenomena are like dreams.
So now just to make sure I'm clear here and also for our audience too. So suffering, this is my understanding of the second noble truth, is that suffering is generated by our desires. Is that correct? Would that be a good summary?
That's part of it. That's part of it. I mean, desires are always driving our attachment to even not just food, people, and things, but our reputation, right? We can see how our desires drive us to engage in negative actions.
Yeah. And again, this is another interesting thing. It's somewhat similar to Christianity in the sense that in James it says your desire is what's causing you your problems. You kill and covet because you do not get what you want. And so to a certain degree, there is another similarity there in that the Bible teaches us that a lot of times we have desires that are causing us problems and we're desiring the wrong things, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, and so forth. So, and then the third noble truth is?
True paths. So basically we put the antidote to these negative states of mind. So with attachment or desire, we practice non-attachment. Okay, understanding that pleasure is just temporarily. I mean, if we're 5 seconds with, you know, chocolate, to maybe 5 minutes on the beach walking until your feet start getting sore and so forth. So, you know, pleasures of this world are very temporary. So what we do is we apply antidotes to the negative states of mind, such as attachment would be non-attachment. Jealousy is rejoicing. We're being happy for people's good fortune. Anger, it's patient acceptance. So Buddha taught opponent forces to our tendencies of mind.
Now, attachment specifically, meaning becoming detached, detachment is that if I don't desire this, then I won't suffer. Is that correct? Is that the kind of the correct direction? That if I begin to change how I feel about this particular thing, then when it goes away, or for example, chocolate, if I don't desire chocolate anymore, then it doesn't make me suffer when I don't get it.
Yes, but we understand. See, that's the thing with Buddhism. We go deeper than just that.
Okay.
Because we understand the nature of that chocolate. That chocolate's an appearance to my mind. It's not separate from my mind. And the view of that chocolate, whether it's pleasurable or not, is dependent on my mind. You may love chocolate. Chocolate gives me headache. So if from its own side, chocolate were a source of happiness, that means everyone who ate chocolate would be happy. And that's not the case.
So you're not saying the chocolate doesn't exist, but you're saying what it means to us is in our mind?
Exactly. And okay. So to a valid mind, there's chocolate appearing, but it's appearing to eye consciousness. It's your consciousness that's appearing that chocolate. It's not just chocolate happening to come from Trader Joe's. You know, it's like there's a dependent arising between your mind and the appearance of that chocolate.
What would be the purpose of the chocolate existing in the first place if our goal is to want to live without it? And I guess that would apply to any pleasure.
Well, as Buddhists, we can transform it. In the new Kadampa tradition, we actually engage in the union of what we call sutra, which are common teachings that Buddha gave, and tantra, which are the uncommon teachings. Very few people actually receive these teachings. But Geshe Kelsang Gyatso, who's the founder of our tradition, actually integrates the union of these two. So with tantra, what we're doing is we're taking pleasure, and instead of trying to avoid pleasure, we're actually using pleasure in a way to transform the causes of the pleasure. So we're not seeing the object as the source of our pleasure, but we're using that pleasure of our mind to actually transform it.
Okay, so if I'm following this correctly, it's the mind that made it pleasurable. So with that same function of the mind, you can now find the pleasure in something else. Is that kind of?
Well, with tantra, we really transform it into something even different, more pure.
Okay. Not
to get too complicated, but I just wanted to illustrate that in our tradition, we actually engage in the union of sutra and tantra. And just to come back to the initial question, what is Buddhism? It's really to train your mind to identify those negative states of mind, replace them with positive states of mind, and really move along a spiritual path to what we call enlightenment. So enlightenment is really literally an enlightened mind, an awakened mind, like Buddha Shakyamuni, the first to do this in this world.
Now, is this pretty universal? Because I know that there are widely varying degrees of Buddhism. And is what you're saying universal, or is this, so if you were to look at the Theravada form of Buddhism, would they agree with what you're saying now, or would they have a different perspective on exactly how you understand getting rid of suffering?
Yes, I mean, Buddha gave teachings, 84,000 teachings when he arose from his meditation. And what happened is those teachings spread like other religious forms. So it went to Asia, where you get Zen, you have Theravada, and Kadampa actually went to Tibet, okay, through the great Indian master Atisha. So there's going to be different views, obviously. The destination is going to be the same if they're Mahayana Buddhists. So Mahayana, we're motivated to liberate not just ourselves, but all living beings without exception from this vicious cycle of suffering, which is birth, aging, sickness, death, and all those other types of sufferings.
And the goal, when you say to release them from that suffering, what you're saying is the goal is that they would stop reincarnating. Is that correct?
No, the goal is to actually have them understand the real nature of things rather than how things appear.
But isn't it true that Buddhism teaches that as you progress, what's going to happen is you're going to achieve enlightenment, and then from there you have the opportunity to go to nirvana or to achieve nirvana. Is that true, or is that...
Okay, that's a good question. We'll hear the answer when we return. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
This is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Co-hosting with me today is Kevin Conover, and we're very happy to have our guest, Choki, who is a Buddhist nun. Some of you probably didn't even think Buddhist nuns existed. Kevin, you were in the middle of a very interesting question when we went to the break.
Yeah, so what I was asking, Choki, is when a person achieves enlightenment, which, as far as I understand it, is a perfect realization of how things are, so it's a perfect understanding of all of reality, which gives them freedom from all suffering because they understand desire perfectly and how it causes suffering and so forth. So my question was, what if they're enlightened, do they then go to nirvana or do some people stay back? What happens at that point?
Mm-hmm. So it's a good question about enlightenment. So enlightenment literally means an inner light of wisdom, free from mistaken appearance. That's what it means. And so as bodhisattvas, we train through what are called the six perfections: giving, moral discipline, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom. Those are actual methods in which we train to become an enlightened being. A bodhisattva is someone who's saying, look, I'm not stopping until all living beings are liberated from this vicious cycle of suffering. And this impure cycle of suffering is uncontrolled birth, right? Sickness, aging, and death. All those other types of sufferings that I mentioned earlier. No one has control of changing those. Temporarily, we can get relief from those sufferings, but that's just changing suffering.
Mm. Okay, so the goal is ultimately that nobody is suffering anymore is the goal.
Correct.
And that is through helping people understand existence in a way that makes it so that they don't suffer anymore because they don't desire things that would cause suffering.
Through those six perfections that we need to train our minds, that we can't just sort of jump over tendencies we have, which are this idea that I'm more important than you. This is one of the main ideas that really obstruct our spiritual practice from a Buddhist perspective, is that we're thinking more about ourselves than others. And when we neglect others, we call this self-cherishing. So our main goal is to actually remove this obstacle of thinking I'm more important than you and to cherish others. So actually, I look at you, Kevin, and I think, no, wait a minute, Kevin is important. His happiness matters. And through the six perfections, I give, I hold back from harming, right? I am patiently accepting. I'm putting effort joyfully. I'm remembering. And I'm using wisdom in particular to understand that you're just in an appearance to my mind, not outside my mind.
Okay, but now there are sufferings that are unrelated to that. For example, if somebody gets hit by a tsunami wave, that has nothing to do with whether we're feeling selfish or more important than somebody. So how would that relate?
So that relates through karma. So through our selfish intention, we've engaged in negative actions and planted these potentials in our mind. And when all the right causes come together, like a rainbow, you know, all the right causes and conditions have to come together and a rainbow appears, it appears, right? So it's the same. We plant potentials on our mind through our actions. And when all the right causes and conditions come together, we experience the effect. So when people shorten the lives of others, their lives are shortened. So it's not to, we understand this is called the law of karma, actions and effects.
Okay, now when we start talking about laws, natural laws and spiritual laws that have cause and effects, it makes us start thinking about God. I know that Buddhists view God very differently than Christians do. And I know there's a spectrum of beliefs amongst Buddhists too. I've heard some Buddhists describe themselves as atheists, but the God that we would be talking about, Buddha came out of Hinduism and he did have a belief in Brahman, didn't he?
Buddha Shakyamuni, yes, was obviously came from an Indian family.
So would we say then that it is Brahman who's in a sense setting the rules to determine the fate as a result of bad karma? Obviously, when we talk about in a sense, karma is kind of like your life catches up with you, if not in this life, in the next life. It's almost as if somebody's out there refereeing, and yet I know that the belief in Brahman is different than the biblical God. He's not viewed as an entity outside of the universe, but he actually is the universe. So how would that go together? How would that work? Where exactly would these rules of karma be coming from, and how would they relate to Brahman?
Okay, it's a good question, and I'll be honest with you, Bob, I can't answer that
one.
Because I feel like it's going so far back into history.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure.
So it's something, so it's a rule that you've observed as a spiritual rule, but the origin of it, some uncertainty about.
Well, the origin comes from my perspective from Buddha Shakyamuni, who was the first to actually give these teachings in this world.
What would he have based it on? Would he have said would he have said this is true for this reason, and I know this is true because of A, B, and C, or would he have?
Well, what he would have said is from, suffering comes from negative actions. Happiness comes from virtuous actions. If we believe in this, we believe in karma.
So I have a question along these same lines, and I know if you can't, it's no big deal. But we actually have something, you reap what you sow, right? The Bible says a man cannot scoop fire into his bosom and not be burned. It's basically saying but then it references God. Of course, it says God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And so the question is, in what we're dealing with a personal God who said, hey, murder is wrong because I say it's wrong. Loving your neighbor is good because I said loving your neighbor is good. Because I love, because I am love, right? Telling the truth is right because I am truth, right? So we have all these things emanating from the character of God. And on the other hand, karma, it's interesting to me. It almost seems like a law in the sense like a law of physics, like the law of gravity. It just is, and it's there, and you have to deal with it, whatever the case, right? And so the question I have is, how is an inanimate force able to delineate with a conscious being what is right and wrong? And for example, like a grizzly bear, right? I used this example last week too.
We had a grizzly bear on our show last week. Yeah.
So I used the example last week of grizzly bears. Male grizzly bears will eat their own cubs. That's horrible, right? But for animals, it's kind of like neither here nor there. They're not moral creatures in the same way we're moral creatures. They don't talk about it. They don't feel guilty. The bear doesn't walk away feeling guilty. And so the question is, if karma is this kind of unconscious force, how is it able to distinguish moral right and wrongs in a conscious moral being? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And so it's just a different view, actually, Kevin, because from our view, we're seeing that actually our actions aren't coming outside. It's not like there's some sort of referee saying, oh, okay, they just did something bad. Now this is going to happen. Kind of coming back to what Bob was talking about earlier. Our actions deem an effect. It is scientific. And so even though that living being, the bear, can't mentally say, boy, you know what, I'm not going to kill my cubs today. I'm actually going to go eat some berries instead. They are experiencing potentials that they're putting on their mind in the continuum of their mind. Because as Buddhists, we ask ourselves, when did our mind begin? We can't find the beginning. So we determine that we've existed since beginningless time.
Okay, very interesting discussion, and we'll be right back. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician.
Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Hi, this is Dana Wright here to announce that Bob Siegel has finally entered the 21st century. It had to happen sooner or later. Now, Bob's popular book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, is available in ebook format and can be downloaded to your Kindle or Nook. Whenever Bob speaks, people are eager to purchase this book afterwards. But sometimes parents inform him that their kids will not read anything that they can't put on an e-reader. Well, now that is no longer a problem. So if you want a book that can help everyone in your family offer better answers to good, skeptical questions that people ask about Christianity, go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com for I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel, now available for download as an ebook.
Back to KCBQ 1170. I am your host, Bob Siegel, and co-hosting the show with me again today is Kevin Conover. We've got a great guest, very interesting, fascinating. Her name is, was it Chokey, right?
Chokey.
Yes. I almost said Cokey, but it's because I drink so much Coca-Cola. That's probably one of those pleasures that Buddhism would think I should transform into something else. But we were talking about karma. Now, Christians don't believe in karma. Well, there are some Christians that would say they do. It's not a biblical concept, but we're big believers here on this program of letting minds meet, and we're having a very friendly discussion, even though we're obviously approaching life from a point of disagreement on some matters. But we were in the middle of a discussion about karma, and I will let you, Chokey, go ahead and continue from where you left off.
Right. So what we're looking at is just how it works, because we think that karma is something outside, that there's something sort of refereeing the effects that we're experiencing in our life. So as Buddhists, what we understand is that actually our mind has tendencies. So certain people have tendencies to getting angry. Certain people have tendencies to attachment to food and so forth. And so what we can do is choose to understand that the experiences we're having aren't coming from outside. They're created through tendencies of habit. And so again, when we propagate these tendencies again and again, we're experiencing the effect. So each time we take an action, a body, speech, and mind, we plant a potential on the garden of our mind or the field of our mind. And when all the right causes and conditions come together, we experience the effect. So as Buddhists, what we understand is that there's no one out there creating our life. We're creating our life through our actions, and we experience the effect. Now, what becomes challenging, and this is the big question that actually got me away from Catholicism, was I was always asking the priest, why do bad things happen to good people? And he could never answer that question clearly. In Buddhism, I understand now that in the past, so we believe in past lives. I was saying, since we can't find the beginning of our mental continuum, that means we've had countless past lives. We've engaged in countless actions and planted countless potentials on our mind. And now we're experiencing the effect. What gets tricky is in this life, when you see something bad happening, let's say to someone that's 3 years old, like leukemia, you're like, wow, well, if you're saying they did something bad, how can we say that? They've just been born. How can we?
So you would say they did something bad in the last life, and that's why they're experiencing that in this life?
Not necessarily in the immediate past life.
Some past life,
exactly.
Somewhere down there.
And all the right causes and conditions came together, and now their life is being shortened.
No, it's still... And I know we've brought this up already, and I understand that there may not be a clear answer to this, but we are talking about spiritual slash maybe you might even want to call them scientific laws, but
metaphysical, right?
Metaphysical, yeah. Metaphysical would be a very good word. Metaphysical type laws. But how do you have laws without a lawgiver?
But I mean, a
law is so embedded in sentience. Even if it's because somebody did something in the past life that they shouldn't have done, that's still this running commentary on the way human beings are interacting with each other.
Yeah. And it's kind of like if those thousands of lives, what is keeping track of those thousands of lives and going from one life to the next when we consider it, I guess if you wanted to say scientifically, is there anything other than, hey, this is, we're going to trust this is the way it is, as far as because that three-year-old has leukemia and now that's come from maybe not their immediate past life, but a life before that. How is that carrying forward like that? And how is that law doing that? It would be a phenomenal law to happen without something organizing that law.
Yeah, obviously Buddhists don't believe that happens randomly.
No, it's nothing's
so,
random.
Right. So if it's happening with a purpose, then who's setting that purpose?
We are.
We are setting that purpose.
Correct.
And now would that include the bear too, or just
absolutely
people? Okay.
But the bear doesn't have choice. The bear doesn't have the ability to, what we say, cognize or decide, today I'm not going to eat my children, I'm going to eat berries. He can't actually choose not to harm. His tendencies, because he's a bear in a bear's form, is just deemed by tendencies. And those tendencies are, this is what I do. I'm hungry, I eat. He can't actually change his mind.
Okay, so we have a human being that does something bad, develops bad karma, then comes back as a bear, as maybe a penalty. But the bear is completely unaware of any of this because he's just a bear. And then the bear becomes something else in the next life that wasn't aware that he was a bear. In what sense, then, is a lesson or growth coming out of this, which I would assume would be the ultimate purpose, that we're learning something, that the world would somehow be getting better? And is there evidence that the world is getting any better?
That's a good question. So, I mean, it just depends, doesn't it? I mean, that's the whole point of Buddhism, is that we see that life is suffering. And a lot of times we just want to slap a happy face and say, everything's good. But, you know, we look at what's happening in Syria, Ebola, and West Africa. No, it's not. And so as Buddhists, what we understand is, though, we can break this cycle through training our mind, understanding how things really exist rather than how they appear. So this is the key. This is the distinction of Catholicism or Christianity and Buddhism, is this wisdom view of emptiness.
On a practical basis, and I'm just talking this out here, just kind of thinking this through, on a practical basis, I wonder if the world would be better off if more people became Buddhists, or if the world would be better off if more people became Christians. I'm asking this because in Christianity, when we see a situation that is difficult, and I know that Buddhists are very compassionate and compassionate people, and they're taught to be compassionate, and I think that's fantastic. I think that's a great trait. But I feel like there would be a difficulty in a Buddhist going, okay, this child has this leukemia. Now, I do have compassion for him, but he did bring it on himself ultimately. And would that somehow affect that person's attitude towards that child? I would hope not. You seem like an extremely compassionate person, but I'm just wondering if there's a conflict there, and especially with the detachment of I don't want to suffer, therefore I pull myself away from that situation.
Another great question, and you're going to have to detach yourself from the emotion of the suspense to hear the answer, at least as long as the break.
Do your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org.
When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
I'm joined today by my good friend Kevin Conover, another Christian apologist, and Choki, who is a Buddhist nun. We're having a delightful time talking with her and getting to know her. And Kevin, go ahead and continue from where you left off.
Yeah, so just my question was basically, the Bible says when Jesus is talking to Christians, he says, if you visit somebody in prison, you're visiting me. If you give somebody a cup of cold water, you've given it to me. If you've done this. So there isn't this idea that, and there's a point even in the Bible, in the Gospels, where there's a guy and he's blind, and the disciples say to him, hey, whose fault is it, his fault or his parents' fault, that he was born blind? Because the Jews even had this concept that your sins or your parents' sins would actually bring problems on you. And he said, it's neither the man's fault nor his parents' fault. He said, this happened that at this opportunity, I could make him see, and that people would be drawn to me because of this, what I'm about to do right now. And so for a Christian, everything is about drawing people to God. Even suffering is about drawing people to God. And it says, don't get rid of desire, but have right desire, right? In the Psalms, it says, if you delight yourself in the Lord, he will give you the desires of your heart. Meaning what you want to do is not have wrong desire, but have right desire. And so the question I have is, as a Christian, when I see a kid that's in trouble or whatever, I don't think to myself, this kid has somehow brought this on his own. I think sin in the world in general has brought pain and suffering into the world. And although indirectly disobedience brings pain and suffering into the world when we decide to not live according to the standards that God has given us to help us have good lives, we do feel pain and suffering. I don't immediately go, that is a result of something that kid did. And therefore, he's kind of, not to be crude or anything, but he's kind of getting what he deserves in a sense. And so I'm just wondering, on a practical basis, let's say we couldn't prove who was right, which would be a better attitude towards the world, that I need to help this kid in the name of Christ because of what's happened, or that karma has brought that on him from something? I'm just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't just be my view, Kevin. I mean, I don't just think, oh, too bad.
No.
You've got leukemia.
Yeah,
sorry.
No. Well, no, we know you would be very compassionate toward
yeah,
the child.
Yeah.
Yes, but
I would ask, would that compassion be interrupting the karma?
It can, based on our actions. So, for example, we just did a retreat this weekend at our center, mm-hmm. Where we've got meditations where we can literally understand how we can take the suffering of others and give them lasting happiness. So prayer is actually a very important part, too, of Buddhism. It's not just a psychology. It can be for some people. I have people coming through the center who are Jewish, Christian, and they just don't want to yell at the kids so much. And then there's other people who actually really want to become a Buddhist. So when we see people suffering, it deepens our wish to actually protect them. That compassion is a mind wishing to protect. So I'll make prayers for that child.
Now, who are Buddhists praying to?
Buddhists are praying to Buddha.
Oh, wait, hold on one second. Before you answer that question, I don't want to move on to that yet. I just have a quick question here. So you said I make prayers for that person, but is there a potential for that to drop your karma because you're actually attaching now because of your desire for that child, or is that not the case?
That's not the case.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
I mean, my intention, everything comes from our intention. My intention is coming from a compassionate view. I want that child to be free from that suffering. That's my main intention.
Well, then it would seem that your compassion is more compassionate than the karma itself that put that child in that situation in the first place, because you're seeing the child in that situation and you're motivated to try to deliver. the child from that situation. And yet it was karma that put the child in that situation.
Bob, if you check, all of our negativity comes from uncontrolled minds. When you get angry, you don't wake up and go, oh, you know what, today I'm going to get angry at, so-and-so today. It just is spawned because someone says something and does something.
Right, but
like.
Your compassion is not a result of negativity, is it? Your compassion toward the child?
No, but what I'm saying is even when I see that child, I understand that result of leukemia is coming from an uncontrolled action of negativity.
Well, but
it's not like, I just want to say what Kevin said, that it's you're getting what you deserve. We never, ever think like that as Buddhists. We're just thinking about karma in terms to hold back from harming more.
Okay, but would you, if you had the means to heal the child from the leukemia, would you do so?
Of course.
Okay, so I still have to wonder how that interrupts the karma, because the karma is saying it is decreed somehow for the child to have leukemia because of something that went on in some past life. And yet it seems like you want to rectify the situation. It sounds like your compassion is making more sense than the karma.
Well, and karma's not fixed. So it's not like we got a bad rap. It's not like, okay, they've got leukemia, done deal, end of story. Karma is actually very fluid. You can change your karma up. And that's why as Buddhists, we understand that through the power of our prayer, through collectively, you know, as I know as Christians, collective prayer, we can actually shift. The karma for someone through the power of actually Buddha. I mean, Buddha's really doing the actual
okay.
work.
Now, you've obviously studied Buddha a lot more than either one of us, certainly a lot more than me, but from the little bit that I've studied, I have to believe that he would not have been comfortable with people praying to him. That didn't seem like something, I don't believe he ever asked people to pray to him. And why are people praying to Buddha? I know you don't believe he's God, so why are you praying to him?
It's a relationship. Why do you pray to God?
Well,
I mean, it's a relationship that you're building through
right,
that connection.
Right, but I have a relationship with Kevin, and beginning a relationship with you, I would not pray to either one of you. I can certainly relate to you and talk to you. There would be a big difference. When I think of prayer, I'm thinking of worship, and I don't believe Buddha wanted to be worshipped.
I don't think Buddha ever said he shouldn't be worshipped. This is what's so great about Buddhism. Buddhism never says you must do or you shouldn't.
Maybe he left the door open.
Absolutely. He always left the door open.
He was such a humble man. It seems to me he would have been a little embarrassed.
I don't think so because he understood that he had the capacity to help. So it's kind of like coming back to the compassion. He knew he could help. And so through blessing, in Buddhist perspective, blessing is transforming a negative state of mind to a positive one. Okay, or a neutral state of mind to a positive one. We need blessings. Buddha blesses our mind.
Okay, so you're not thinking of it as prayer in exactly the way we would. It'd be more like you're going to a friend and asking him for help.
No, I make prayers every day. We chant our prayers. We have...
So you do view yourself as literally worshiping
Buddha? This is a particular sect of Buddhism. Not all Buddhists hold that view. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Because in 1966, I believe it, there was the World Buddhist Sangha Council, and they had agreed on 9 points. And one of the points was... there is not a creator. We do not believe there is a creator God in that sense. Now, I'm sure Buddha doesn't necessarily qualify as that, but there's a pretty wide disparity as far as those who say, yes, we will pray to Buddha, and those who say, no, we don't pray to Buddha. Because some people believe that once you achieve enlightenment, you almost become supernatural. Some people believe that Buddha became this kind of almost like a Brahmin-like figure, but others feel that he just went on to nirvana and ceases to exist now and just stopped reincarnating. Is that true or no?
Okay,
no.
One more hold, one more segment.
I asked that question at the right time.
Yeah, you're timing them pretty good. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra.
We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Welcome back for one more segment of the Bob Siegel Show. And Kevin, go ahead and just at least repeat the last part of your question for our guest.
Actually, you know what? My mind is blank here. Chokey, can you remember what I asked?
Yeah, it was about enlightenment. And again, once you reach enlightenment, what happens?
Oh, yeah. I was talking about how for some Buddhists, Buddha is a kind of almost a Brahman-like figure in the sense that it's this universal, almost unconsciousness becoming one with...
One with the universe.
Yeah, I've read that nirvana means, at least in one form, means the blowing out of a candle, to cease to exist. And that was the goal, was to stop the reincarnation process. So for you, in your particular tradition of Buddhism, what form is Buddha in now?
Well, we're Mahayana Buddhists. So from our perspective, Buddha has four bodies, actually. One that appears to you and me, so he can relate to us. Another one called the enjoyment body, and only superior beings can see that. And then two bodies that are higher, that only enlightened beings can see. So there's a truth body and a nature body, and that's called the Dharmakaya. So once we understand how things really exist, Buddha can actually see past, present, and future simultaneously and exists in the Dharmakaya.
When he was in his human form before he passed away, had he already achieved that ability to understand reality perfectly? And do you believe that people like yourself, for example, or any Buddhist could actually achieve that to the point where they can understand reality perfectly while they're still living here on Earth?
Yes, I believe that Buddha Shakyamuni did attain enlightenment. And I also believe that my teacher and my spiritual guide, Geshe Kelsang Gyatso, is an enlightened being.
So currently he's an enlightened being in the sense that he understands reality perfectly.
Correct.
Okay, now on the subject of reality, I'd like to get back to the desires, because aren't some desires good?
Absolutely.
So when you talk about overcoming desires, it's just certain desires? There are some desires and emotions that it's good for us to have?
Right. Desires attachment is when we are looking at something and we're exaggerating the good qualities of it, and we're thinking that it is going to be the source of our happiness. And it's a very sticky mind, desires attachment, and it causes suffering. But I can also desire to become a Buddha, so that's a good desire. I can desire to eat, that's a neutral desire, if it's not, you know, with attachment. You know, it just depends on the intention again and the mind.
Now, I've read quite a bit on Buddhism, and I'm hearing things from you that are different than what I've read. So I'm not always sure if it's because it was a particular sect of Buddhism or what the case is. So
that's correct. There's different views, so you've probably read different views of Buddhism.
So one of the views that I've read is that everything around us is temporary, and therefore it's impermanent. And that being the case, when you desire it, you suffer when you lose it. If you desire anything that's temporary, and therefore the only and this has to do with the permanence versus impermanence, that the only thing that's permanent is once you've achieved nirvana, is to attain that. Nirvana, that's permanent, and therefore that is the ultimate goal of Buddhism, is to be in that place of permanence, has been my understanding.
But that's a Hinayana view of nirvana. As Mahayana Buddhists, we go beyond just nirvana and we go to enlightenment, where you actually need to then have a direct realization of emptiness. Again, understanding how things really exist rather than how
they
appear.
Okay, let's go back to that, because you've mentioned that several times. What is the difference between the way we think things exist and the way things really exist? Because I don't hear you saying, like a Christian Scientist, that this world doesn't really exist. But evidently there's something about this world, at least our perception of it, that doesn't really exist.
Well, it's the way we're perceiving it, Bob. We're seeing it outside our mind.
Okay, so what am I perceiving about this world? Or just use myself as an example, that's not really true. Give me an example of something that's true about this world, whereas your average person in this world thinks the world's a certain way, but they're not really seeing the truth of it.
Well, most people see others independent, separate from themselves. So I'm sitting across from you right now, Bob, and you're thinking, there's this nun sitting across the table from me. You're not thinking that actually
So part of the perception is that we're really all one in unity somehow and not separate.
That our minds are related to what's appearing. So it's a dependent, what we call a dependent arising.
So we are two separate beings, but somehow we have a common mind?
Not a common mind, but actually we have karma together. We have collective karma. So okay. Now we're seeing each other.
Okay.
And so there's a dependent arising. All the causing conditions came together. And now there's an appearance of Bob. But like in 15 minutes, that will cease to appear.
Yeah, but I won't cease to exist.
No.
I'll just cease to appear because we won't be in the same room.
But that's consciousness. That's your mind. So it's like last night's dream. So Buddha said everything
so
is...
So I only exist in your mind then?
Not just in my mind, but others' minds as well because of karma.
So it's kind of like if a tree's alone in the forest, doesn't make a sound when it falls. If I'm not actually in the room with somebody else to see me in their mind, I don't actually exist?
No, that's not true. Because we know that you can call up your friend and talk to them on the phone. It's about our mind. It's not that something doesn't exist. To a valid mind, Bob is appearing. But what's different is we think inherently existent, Bob, meaning separate from myself. We don't see that I have anything to do with you being there.
Okay, what is the value of somehow being attached to a collective mind as opposed to having an individual mind?
Well, it's not a collective mind, Bob, because actually no two people have engaged in the same actions, so no two people have the exact same mind. But what it is we do have collective
karma.
We have collective karma. So we've engaged in actions in the past, and now we're experiencing the effect of that, okay? And so based on those actions, we're having this conversation. This isn't an accident. The three of us are sitting here having this conversation even.
What is the ultimate goal for you in Buddhism? What, if you were to achieve not just enlightenment, but the final step, it quote, Buddha's whatever heaven, what would that be exactly?
It's a good question. So from my perspective, my goal is to temporarily help others to relieve themselves through training their minds, controlling their minds through Buddhist teachings. Okay, so that's my initial goal. Ultimately, I want to progress along my spiritual path to attain enlightenment. And ultimately, we want to keep coming back. It's not like once you attain enlightenment, you're done.
Okay, so that's a different view that your particular group has from others. Isn't that correct? Because for some, the goal is actually a nirvana, a ceasing to exist. Is that true?
I don't know enough about that to answer that question correctly.
Okay.
But again, getting back to the question of the rules, this is a process that's obviously not random, and yet there's no God, there's no one personality behind all of it. So you would have to just say this is the way it works, but it's a mystery how it works?
Well, karma is a hidden object. We can't find the exact causes that are creating the experiences we're having. So it is a hidden object. It takes faith to actually believe in karma. But faith from a Buddhist perspective is when it's a virtuous mind that opposes seeing the fault in its perceived object. That's how we define faith in Kadampa Buddhism.
But isn't that based on an opinion that is a fault? Because some of the desires that you listed, even eating chocolate, are not, I mean, in moderation, I don't think eating chocolate's necessarily a bad thing.
And I never said it was.
Okay.
What about
being a desire that we wanted to somehow detach ourselves?
Yeah, but we could use another example, and we're going to run out of time here. But we could use an example of eating an animal. Or is your form of Buddhism vegetarian?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so I'm a vegetarian.
Would eating an animal be considered bad karma?
Not necessarily. It depends, because some people need to eat animal to be healthy. So
what if they didn't need to eat an animal to be healthy, but they just enjoyed eating it?
I still wouldn't blame or do anything because everybody has choice.
Okay, we are out of time. This was fascinating. Choki, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me on the show.
It was just a delight to get to know you, and God bless you.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.